is Chetan Mufugir, the chairperson of the Select Committee on Security and Constitutional Development. Before we start, even though we are so many, I will allow everyone here to introduce himself or herself. And I've also been made aware that there are other people interested in the briefing who are here as observers. Can we start on my right from Tadeusz Kosana here?
Thanks, Chair. My name is Teresa Ross from the Department of Justice Legislation Development.
Morning, Chair. My name is Lawrence Bassett, Department of Justice Legislation.
Good morning. My name is Joy, Chairperson, Co-opta Limpopo.
Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Louis Mande from the City of Choice, KZN.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Matona from the Chairperson of Co-opta in Sopi. I'm a member of the committee.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Good morning, Chair. My name is Dennis Bloom. I'm a member of the committee, and I'm from the Free State, the same province that you are coming from. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Tunka Matila, a member of the committee representing Gauteng.
Good morning. My name is Lebogang Mampi. I'm a committee administrator and the local government and housing at the Gauteng Provincial Legislature.
Good morning. My name is Molefi Masilo, the researcher for Local Government and Housing Portfolio Committee, Gauteng Provincial Legislature.
Good morning. My name is Nkadi Shara Sabota, Legal Advisor from NCP Legal, Gauteng Provincial Legislature.
Good morning. My name is Errol Magnum, Chairperson for Local Government and Housing, also dealing with traditional leaders from Gauteng Provincial Legislature.
Good morning, my name is Chabulile Nyembe, Committee Coordinator, Local Government and Housing from Housing Legislature.
Good morning, my name is Nonzwaga Sortboy from KZN, Chairperson of COCT.
Sanbonane Usbonisa Duma from KwaZulu Natal Legislature.
Sanbonane Ulindwe Bibi, KwaZulu Natal Legislature.
Good morning, my name is Francois Skippers, Deputy Chair, Soul of Western Cape.
Good morning, my name is Cindy Somnisi Weeks. I'm a senior researcher at the Law, Race and Gender Research Unit at UCT.
Good morning, my name is Marek Besson. I'm the NCFD Liaison Officer for the Free State Legislature.
Good morning, my name is Jackie Tsuku, Free State Legislature Committee Coordinator, COCTA HS.
Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Alma Cronier, Free State Legislature Research Section.
Good morning to all members. My name is Pumela Lengema, Parliamentary Legal Advisor.
Good morning. My name is Wonani from the Justice Committee Secretary.
Morning, honorable members. My name is Beni Nonyani. I'm the Procedural Advisor in the National Council of Provinces.
Good morning, honorable members and chairperson. My name is Langa from the Parliamentary Notion Group.
Good morning, chairperson. My name is Patience Mpalo, NCOP Liaison Officer from Mpumalanga.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Jonas Ramokwase, Free State Legislature, COCTA Portfolio Member.
Morning, John Franson, Member, Northwest Provincial Legislature.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Johan Fischer. I'm the Chairperson, Standing Committee on Governance, Western Cape Parliament.
Good morning. I'm Mike Walters, member of the Western Cape Parliament.
Good morning, Dennis Joseph, NCLC.
Morning, my name is Jabu Mahlangu, Mpumalanga Legislature, member.
Morning, my name is Mpos Yabela, Limpopo Liaison Officer, Cape Town.
Morning, everyone. My name is Machaka, Legal Advisor for State Legislature.
Good morning, everyone. Mfuzo Dana, Northwest Liaison Office in the NCOP.
Good morning, Chairperson. I am Stella Mhlana, NCOP Coordinator, Eastern Cape.
Morning, I'm Khoshikadi Mutapo, Deputy Chairperson of National House of Traditional Leaders. Thank you.
Morning, my name is Khumuto Kegana, a member of the National House of Traditional Leaders.
Good morning, my name is Gail Eddy from SALGA Parliamentary Office.
Good morning, my name is Billy Brown, I'm a journalist with the City Press.
Good morning, my name is John Gunnar. I'm from the Northern Cape. I'm from the hottest town in South Africa called Upington, and I'm a member of this committee. Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Nomboni Sokaso. I'm an independent research and analyst on gender and cultural issues. Thank you.
Good morning, my name is Monica D'Souza, and I'm a researcher at the Law, Race and Gender Unit at UCT.
Good morning, my name is Aninka Klaasens, and I'm a researcher at UCT.
Good morning, my name is Melody Lewaya. I'm also a researcher at UCT.
Good morning, I'm Chuma Himonga, Professor of Law and Chair in Customary Law at UCT.
Good morning, my name is Nkai Njosivanda. I'm a research coordinator at UCT's Chair in Customary Law.
Thank you very much. Without any waste of time, I'll hand over to the department to continue the briefing.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. We welcome this opportunity today to come and brief the Select Committee. And we are also humbled by the presence of so many of the members inside here and interested institutions. I've prepared a slide presentation and I'll just go through it, and my colleagues will add after I've made a presentation. As I've said before, we are the team from the department. I'm from the policy development unit, and I'm accompanied by my colleagues who are from the legislative drafting unit. We have been involved in this process for quite some time, as many of ourselves here would be aware. The presentation seeks to give basically historical background of the traditional justice system, just in a crisp manner, give background to the traditional courts bill, then referring by the Law Reform Commission, its bill accompanying the report of the Law Reform Commission, the policy framework and introduction of the traditional courts bill in Parliament, in Parliament, in 208. It gives an overview of the concerns raised during the parliamentary hearings in the National Assembly. It gives the key policy considerations arising from the comments, and whether comments have been taken into consideration by the department. Six, it gives an overview of the transformation of the traditional courts as part of a broader transformation discourse of the justice system. Seven, we also seek to give view of the transformation of the justice system. Let's say constitutional imperatives, what inform the transformation of the traditional court system. We are also touching on the consequences that arise from the delay in finalizing the traditional courts bill. We also look at traditional courts functioning outside the constitutional and legislative framework as part of that consequence. We look at opportunity that could enhance access to justice. And we close with few recommendations to the Select Committee. Chair, we deal here with a very oldest form of justice system known, the traditional justice system. It's got its own archaic origin. It's not a recent origin. So this legislation and our approach make that recognition. Research indicates that the system could have been distorted from its original purest form. And obviously the colonialism and the apartheid system have much influence on the traditional justice system as was known. As I've said, it is the oldest known form of state and society organization before the advent of colonialism and apartheid. It was entrenched by the Black Administration Act, which is known to have been the bastion of the policy of segregation of the erstwhile government. Everything that Black Administration Act provided for everything that pertained to African at the time, separate from the entire arrangement that applied to other racial groups. So they had their own court systems, they had their own form of administration, when the Bazabandu, they had their form system of governance, all entrenched in the Black Administration Act, whilst the other racial groups were dealt with a separate legislative regime, etc. You will notice that it's only as early as 1986 that there have been a formal integration within the justice system, when the separate courts which existed for Africans were discontinued and they've been integrated within one court system for the Republic. It has taken time to have the act repealed, mainly because of the fact that it could not have been repealed without putting in place an alternative legislative framework. It could have been possible to repeal an act automatically in 1994 or 1999, but it provides so many aspects that need to be taken through other legislative processes. So there were quite a number of legislation that were developed outside the Black Administration Act by this government. The Recognition of Customary Marriages Act is one such example of the bill. So before you repeal the act, you have to make sure that you have provided an alternative regime. Otherwise, there will be a vacuum that will create some form of chaos. So when in 1927, the time came for the department to initiate a bill that will repeal the entire Black Action Act, it was realized that doing so without having an alternative legislation for the traditional courts will also create a huge gap in terms of those courts. So what happened then? Parliament was asked to pass a special act that will only save Section 12 and Section 20 of the Black Administration Act. So the Black BAA was repealed, Section 12 was saved, and up to date Section 12 continued to operate. And Section 12 basically, Section 12 provides for the adjudication of civil disputes by traditional courts. Section 20 provides for the resolution of criminal disputes by the traditional courts. Those acts were kept as they were from the BAA with no adjustments. Hence, the understanding that those acts will be repealed by a comprehensive bill. So we've got only two sections that manage this process moving forward. As a result, those are short sections. They are not very comprehensive. They are not adequate, and therefore they are also reminiscent of the old order discriminatory dispensation. Their repeal is an essential element of the transitional justice system. I'll give some brief background later on how inadequate those sections are in terms of the current realities. As part of leading this process of reforming the traditional courts, the South African Law Reform Commission conducted an investigation and submitted and compiled a comprehensive report after they've engaged in broad, extensive consultations. And obviously, even at that time, very many key elements of the traditional system came to the fore, as they have came to the fore today. So those are the things which were raised during the public consultation processes are the same things that continue to be raised here and which require some careful consideration. in terms of creating a system that is consistent with our constructive value system. The Law Reform Commission recommended, among others, that customary costs be retained, and that they be established parallel to our court system, and that they be formalized in terms of their own court infrastructure, in terms of their personnel, in terms of their IT, that there be tags of the court, there be transcriptions of records, there be appeal mechanisms to the upper level of the customary courts, etc. The report was accompanied by a customary courts bill, which sought to give effect to the recommendation of the Law Reform Commission. The minister then, government then, did not approve the law reports, the Southern Law Reform Commission's report and the bill, and its bill. Although a number of principles, the major principles in the bill were accepted, it was not approved in its entirety, simply because of policy considerations that will emanate from that dispensation. The view was that the establishment of a parallel court system alongside the magistrate courts would perpetuate segregation, would lead to overlapping of the jurisdiction with that of the magistrate courts, and the court infrastructure, personnel and IT additional to the existing court infrastructure would be an administrative and financial burden to the state. Traditional courts, the history is that they exercise almost similar jurisdiction like magistrate courts. In the Eastern Cape, the Old Transkei, they could even impose sentences, etc. The only difference was that for sentences of the magistrate court to be put into effect, they had to be confirmed by a magistrate, not that they must be retried by a magistrate. So there was that understanding that the traditional courts operated within the old form of the commissioner's courts. They shared almost the same jurisdiction, whatever. All they needed was to have their sentences approved or endorsed by the magistrate court for them to be put into operation. Hence, continue with the traditional courts in the original format would create a lot of uncertainty and overlapping. The preferred position was therefore to establish traditional courts as special type courts, which would supplement the conventional court system with emphasis on alternative dispute resolution mechanism. That was the thinking when the Law Reform Commission was not adopted. That don't have two courts that exercise the same jurisdiction, but have one court system that complements the other, where you can increase access to justice, where people could resolve their cases speedier with inflexible approach and all those things, in the very same manner that we have other ADR system working, like the small claims court, whatever, etc. So provide a mechanism that allows the resolution of dispute without going through the tedious formal justice process. That's the policy principle which at the time we felt was not embodied in the Law Reform Commission and the bill. The Law Reform Commission suggested a court system without basically indicating how the two were going to be aligned. Therefore, the minister then said, to the extent that there is this policy shift, that we need a court that complements the formal court system, the minister initiated a policy process that should basically reflect that policy and adjust the bill and legislation that will give effect thereto. And that happened into it when the then minister went to cabinet, presented that policy document to cabinet, approved by cabinet, which was going to emphasize aspects of alternative dispute resolution, aspect of restorative justice, and reconciliation. And that after the approval of the policy process led to the traditional courts bill as we have it today. So the bill was introduced in 2008 into parliament, and the National Assembly conducted hearings, public hearings on the bill. There were substantive inputs and comments in relation to the bill, etc. And those were recorded as they were. some of the aspects which are of fundamental importance, which came out of the publications and the following. One, there was a view that the bill confers more power on traditional leaders than they had under the BAA. So there was a view that the traditional courts bill is more draconian. It gives more powers to traditional leaders than they had under the BAA. And that was basically inferred from the provision in the bill that recognizes traditional leaders as presiding officers equal to the status of magistrates in the courts. Two, there was extensive comments and views that the bill does not go far enough to provide adequate protection for the rights of women. It did not provide measures to address past gender prejudices. It did not provide positive measures to address the inequalities across the system. There was also submission that the bill does not recognize different layers in the traditional court system. It does not recognize that dispute resolution starts at family level, goes at head men, head women level, before it goes to court, etc. Although this fact was acknowledged in the initial policy document approved by cabinet, the bill did not articulate this element succinctly. There was also views that the community service sanctions have the potential for abuse by traditional leaders. There were no inbuilt mechanisms or checks and balances in the bill that will ensure that the community sentences may be imposed to the benefit of traditional leaders and not the community. Community sentences are those non-custodial sentences where people will be required to clean cemeteries, will be required to perform community services rather than going to jail, etc. But since the bill did not indicate how they could be performed, the concerns raised during the public hearings were that those community services could basically be designed to benefit traditional leaders. We may get people who are sentenced to come and build houses for traditional leaders or take care of their children or take them to school, whatever, etc. There was also a view that the bill deprives community of the right to legal representation, which is a human right enshrined in the bill, in the constitution. There were strong views that that right is basically, the deprivation of that right is unconstitutional from the bill. There was a view that civil jurisdiction should be based on consent of the parties, and that the court's criminal jurisdiction was inconsistent with the constitution. That the parties should lead the criminal prosecutions on behalf of the state lie with the National Prosecuting Authority, and therefore traditional leaders cannot initiate prosecution themselves and hear the case themselves and sentence. You put all powers in one individual, and therefore it was inconsistent with the constitutional dispensation that underlie this democratic order. It was also submitted that the bill doesn't provide the right to opt out in certain instances to give a choice to pursue legal redress in the magistrate courts or conventional courts. This remained a sticky point which the Law Reform Commission even acknowledged and deferred to policymakers. It was also submitted during the hearing that the appeal to the magistrate courts and the choice of legal system where more than one conflict customary law values applied were cumbersome, where you find people staying within the same community, subscribe to different customary laws, and when the court had to apply to administer those laws, it becomes very cumbersome that people be subjected to a customary law value system to which they did not subscribe. An appeal system within the customary law itself was made mainly by the Institute of Traditional Leaders. There was a view that don't appeal the magistrate courts because they apply a different legal system. Create appeal courts to be dealt with by the highest levels of traditional leaders within the traditional communities. There was the ninth point, which was very critical, and which we think this point should address, is the view that there was a lack of adequate consultation with communities who were affected by the bill. A major consultation at the time was largely with traditional institutional leadership and there was no sufficient consultation with the communities at local level, and there was that feeling that that should be corrected before the bill is enacted. We all know that after the submissions, the bill was withdrawn by the minister from the National Assembly, and the bill was introduced in the National Council of Provinces. I thought that it's important to raise key policy considerations that arose out of those submissions, which this process must deal with, etc. And I said, those processes are not new processes. They have been raised during the Law Reform Commission. They are going to remain sticky points. You'll have to find a way of aligning and harmonizing them with the constitutional framework at the end of the day. One, the major question is whether the Treasurer Court should remain part of the judicial system, or must they be complementary to the judicial system. In Chapter 8, the Constitution, Section 166, set out the judicial system. It says, the judicial system of this country consists of the following. It starts with the constitutional courts and ends with the Magistrate Court in 166. It mentions all the courts that form a judicial system. It then go on and indicate how judicial officers get appointed, how judicial officers get trained, what's the role of the Judicial Service Commission appointment, how they get disciplined, the judges and magistrates, and all those aspects, all in Chapter 8. But when you read Chapter 8, it talks to the judicial system. Now the question is, if the traditional courts are linked to the judicial system, then all the processes that pertains and apply to judiciary then become applicable. But if you then provide as an alternative or complementary justice system, then you need not apply all those principles, because traditional leaders are not interviewed by the JSC. They get their status and position by birth and ordainment. So the important thing is that as we look at the courts, there have to be that kind of distinction. The second point which came there is what is the effect of the Chancellor justice system on the principle of separation of powers, the independence of the judiciary and the legal representation. I said earlier that it is the only form of system. In the judicial system, judges don't investigate cases. They hear cases. There are police, there's a prosecutor, then there's somebody who comes and adjudicates over the matters. And those independent lines are kept throughout the system. It would not be desirable to have a system where somebody is a player and a referee at the same time. Investigate, arrest, issue notices, and come and listen and adjudicate. All those aspects will have to be looked into as part of revisiting and refining the data and making consistent the Constitution. The issue of judicial independence. If such leadership sit in court and adjudicate, implement legislation, take care of some of the executive functions moving forward, all those aspects are aspects that require clear articulation. And therefore, the question has always been whether should they be called courts under the judicial system, and whether they should be seen as special kind of an arrangement that seeks to enhance access to justice. And we'll come to those aspects. But before we come to those aspects, there's one important aspect wanted to indicate to this house and to everybody present here, is that when the bill was reintroduced as is before the National Council of Provinces, it did not imply that all the submissions which were made were not taken into consideration. It is for that reason that today we have even rehashed them, we have stated them, that here are the summaries of the submissions which have been given in. We have collated a report of all the concerns, all the submissions which were raised, all the articles which were written on this subject, and all of them, including the article written in today's case trial, we have read it and analyzed it, etc. And we have said, all the submissions have pointed to the very same aspects that I've mentioned, those nine aspects in broad sense, which need to be addressed. And therefore, the fact that the bill which has been introduced is the same bill as introduced in 208 does therefore not mean that we did not take those views into consideration. All it meant, one, it meant that during the time when the bill was introduced in the National Assembly, the consultations were conducted by the National Assembly at national level. The portfolio committee's view was therefore that this bill, being a 76 bill to the constitution, required more inputs at provincial and local level. And therefore the bill was introduced with the main purpose of facilitating further inputs at the local level within the communities which are mainly affected by the bill, with the understanding that all the comments submitted, all the views expressed, all the articles written, everything which have been taken into account will then be considered by this House as part of revising the bill and making and creating and developing out of this process a text that will clearly be consistent to the Constitution but also addresses the major concerns which have been raised. It would have taken us more time if one would have revised the bill after they have been in Parliament. Two, would have taken the bill through the entire process of introduction, take the bill through the to Cabinet, take the bill through to State Law Advice Facilitation and bring it back here. The view is that the way the current Section 12 and 20 are so inadequate, the manner in which traditional courts continue to function outside a proper legal framework were compelling enough for the legislation to be fast-tracked. So the date of 31st December 2012, the date by which Parliament has said is the deadline for the introduction of the new Act, would have been defeated if we had gone through the entire process from the beginning. Hence, the bill that you see before you is the same bill which was before the National Assembly, etc. And we trust and hope that this process will help clean the bill at the end of the day. Having said that, it is therefore important to put that in a proper perspective and to say that this committee will basically be better positioned to hear the submissions, to take view of submissions made, to listen to submissions, to the views that the department had collated, the report had collated in terms of submissions made, and this committee take appropriate steps to redress those views raised. Within that context, I'd wanted to bring some few points to the fore. One, the transformation of the social cause is not an isolated event. It is not. All these causes we have today operate in terms of how they inherited in 1994. And there's a process underway to rationalize them, to clean them up, to reconstruct them, to transform them, to bring them the Constitution. Both in terms of the demarcations and both in terms of the laws they apply. The only major transformation which was implemented since 1994 is one, is the establishment of the Constitutional Court. Two, is the reconstitution of the appellate division to be the Supreme Court of Appeal. And three is the appointment of judicial officers of color to enhance legitimacy. Those are the major three aspects which have taken place. But to date, the High Court in Pretoria, which we call the North Gauteng High Court, still operate in terms of its own demarcation. It hears cases in Nelspruit. It still operates in terms of the law of the Supreme Court Act of 1959. That act has not been repealed. The magistrate courts all over the country still operate in terms of the Magistrate Court Act of 1944. That act has not been repealed. We have only changed the change has only been in terms of the people on the bench. Now there's a broader process that looks at changing those courts in terms of demarcation. The demarcation are still aligned in terms of the old homelands and Bantustan policies. The court in Danzani, although we have changed, there's no longer Siskai as it existed, still exercise jurisdiction in terms of the old Danzani, not in terms of the current Buffalo City.
and those arrangements still have this, the courts in Bishop still serve the High Court in Bishop, still serve the old Siskai community. And the current process, as you may be aware, that there was a process where the minister introduced a discussion document on the 28th of February, which started the process of reconsidering the courts. And social courts are part of the missionary. They also have to be reconsidered in terms of the process. And all those aspects which inform the reorganization are based on fundamental principles. And the principles which apply to a traditional court are the following. One, the view that traditional courts must be perceived and must be enhanced as the form of the justice system that promotes access to justice. It's where people are able to go there and talk their own language, get their matters resolved expeditiously with no complications whatever. That's the bottom line. Two is the whole aspect which must enhance restorative justice. It is not a retributive system. That will send people to jail. It facilitates harmony between the disputants. If you abolish the system of the court, you basically say that anything that this happens between people must go to the ordinary courts. Our major courts cannot deal with everything at all. They are overloaded. They are overstretched. And if there's any form of mechanism where matters can be taken out of the formal court system and be resolved speedily outside the court system, less expensively, with the application of the rules that people can embrace with, the better for the society. So there's nothing wrong in terms of the system itself. What's important is that system must be refined to be consistent with the Constitution. That's what we seek to achieve at the end of the day. Three, we have the view that traditional court should not be seen to be vested with judicial power, because it can only vest judicial power on the judiciary. Traditional are not the judiciary. They are the leaders. So they exercise what is quasi-judicial power, which is a mixture of administrative and legal principles that help to resolve cases, etc. If there is a hands-on court of judges that they perform a judicial function, they are not judicial officers. Hence, there's a need to recognize that the Constitution provides and recognizes the institution of social leadership. It's not the bill. It's not the social bill that introduces the system. It's the Constitution in Chapter 12. The bill gives effect to the Constitution. So we cannot say we don't wish it away. We cannot say we don't want it. We want to wish it away. That's a broader debate. Because it's part of our system. We must find a way that it must be infused into our system. Two, the Constitution for the first time gives equal recognition to customary law. Before 1994, customary law was only applied when it was not in conflict or inconsistent with the policy of government. Now, we no longer have policy of government that informs the status of law. We've got the Constitution, the supreme law of the land. The Constitution says all laws, including customary law, must be developed to be consistent with the Constitution. It's not for us to wish away customary law. If people want to resolve their way in terms of customary law, they are allowed by the Constitution to do so. In the massive court, if I owe my father-in-law a dollar, it's not a claim that I can take to a court. If I go to an attorney and say I want to issue someone says because I have not been paid to a dollar, the attorney says no, look, that's not a justiciable under the law, go and negotiate. But if my child has been impregnated by your child, when I go to court, they say no, they send you a maintenance court. Go and claim maintenance. But damage and maintenance are different. Damage is the flowering. That is looked in terms of different principles. The market cost and the high cost of the land cannot deal with that matter. Only exceptional cost. Now, if you are building this system, which entrenches our value system that people associate with, you are creating a gap and disorganizing the system entirely. And I said the revision of the Supreme Court of course must be informed by the Constitution. All that we must say, how do you create a system that is consistent and in sync with the Constitution? Not engage in a debate, you say, how do you get rid of the system? That will be a more complex task than the one of refining the system. The Bill of Rights are there. They grant all different rights. They grant cultural rights, etc. With a rider, that those rights they must be consistent with the Constitution. And if the question goes on in 39 and say all courts and all tribunals and all forums must develop customary law. Customary law in terms of Constitution is not developed by traditional leaders. It's traditional is developed by tribunals. I've read some articles that the bill gives traditional leaders power to develop to write customary law. Customary law and customary cultures are the values that are owned by the community themselves. They decide what the value they want to subscribe to. And the traditional court gives effect to those values, does not rewrite them, etc. No one to represent the community can rewrite those principles. In fact, the traditional court system is a one value system that is based on the purest form of democracy. Because that's where people come and people give effect to what they want to see happen. Unlike a quarterly system where the whole decision making is based on one judge. In a traditional court, decision making is not based on the traditional leader, it's based on the community. Traditional leader conveys the decision of the people at the end of the day. Hence, I'm saying that there are basic principles that can be derived from this system and which can further be enhanced and improved so that they can be preserved rather than kicking them out of the process throwing the child with the bathwater. There have been jurisprudence which have been developed around customary law, which shows the improvement and the alignment of customary law with the law. There have been decisions around the inheritance that you cannot continue to disinherit women by virtue of them being women because they have been perpetual minors. We have already moved out of those principles. There's a constitutional court decision which have ruled on the chieftainship of women, the right to accept the throne. All these aspects are part of the evolving jurisprudence, which shows the improvement of the system, etc., which I think all of us must benefit from them. So the debate must be how do we purify and revive and develop customary law from its original discriminatory form to be consistent with the Constitution. Now, having said that, and I've said that, that's the role of the courts, that's the role of the tribunals, that's the role of the community, that's the role of the writers, the universities, whatever. Everybody has got that role to ensure that the system is improved to be what we want, not only to rubbish it, because it affects more than 18 million people of this country. And I don't think that it will just be fair to tell them that system does not belong in this Constitution. It is entrenched in the Constitution. Now, I have said all that. What is the consequence of the delay of this traditional courts bill? There are very fundamental processes. And during the hearings, there were concerns raised, rightfully so, that there are incidences of abuse of powers by traditional courts in some instances, simply because the current Section 12 and Section 20 does not cap those powers. It's still based on the old system. It's not adequate. It doesn't protect the people. So the more we keep these two sections continuing, the more we're creating aid for those communities and the rural villages. As we see today and debate the bill, social courts are continuing there with no legal framework. They issue fines which are not prescribed in law. They issue, and people, some instances, people cannot appeal whatever because they don't know where to go. Or even if they want to appeal, it may be expensive. To go to court is very expensive, so they charge play. So the sooner the bill gets elected, the better for the community to find a system that they can basically relate to. As I've said, that the importance of the social justice system in terms of strengthening social cohesion, the state of nation building, the state of restorative justice is very immense. Social courts is the only system that encourages restorative justice in the ordinary court. When I open the case, tomorrow I come to court, I said, no, they only do one thing, they only fine me or sentence me to jail.
But if the truth is said, no, no, look, we have talked to each other ever, they withdraw the case. They say, oh, case is over. They don't even want to know how have you talked. They don't want to know how long can they help you build each other. Those are rules. Those are rules they must say to build relationship. If you come in the room, feel like we have made peace, they will throw and shit and send the government back and call next case. If after we've gone outside, you got hit again and fight each other, come back, when you come back, they say, go to the police station. They take a statement and bring you there. Shashna calls the only system which says, yes, we are wrong, which has happened. He has a punish before us. How do we help build relationship? And at the end of the case, how do we make sure that we strengthen this relationship, etc.? One of the consequences of the Shashna courts is the unclear rules between of the market court's relation to the Shashna courts system. Currently, Shashna court is court of records, and therefore, when there's no record, cannot appeal. All your pieces are appealing, because when you go to your message that I'm coming to appeal, I've been fined for cattle, for trespasses, then there's no record of the Shashna court, then the message cannot see an appeal. So what happened now is that when you go to contest your appeal, the court wants to hear the whole case from scratch because it does not have the power to allocate over the appeal in the absence of the records. Now, if those cases go to appeal to the court for you outside the judicial of the master court, they can't help you. They send the people back to Nkosin. Then Nkosin loses the court. And does not help. It does not help the people because they get shackled from one place to another. I have talked about the hugely inadequacy of the BAA provisions, and I have talked about there's one principle which applied under the BAA. Is that principle when the minister conferred jurisdiction on individuals by issue certificate? When this minister came, when this advocate came into power, they expressed a concern about that dispensation. Because when you do so, when you give a certificate to an individual, you are basically acting in contravention with the court, because here power rests in the institution, not in the individual. You cannot give a certificate on one individual, go and try. The BA is written in very bad language. It says every chief must go and must try and punish applicants for misdemeanor. That's what it says. And you cannot give a license to just go and punish people for misdemeanor. That's what I said, I cannot continue with that arrangement. It needs to be refined, etc. And the more we deal with it, the more there's no clear certainty by socializers on what role they must play in terms of the social justice system. Having said all this, Chair, we see that we would want this committee to note the historical background of the social justice system and its importance in the injustice of justice. And the fact that cannot be wished away. And two, this committee to know the history of the Social Courts Bill and take into account all the comments made on the bill in the past. So that, and also that as they hear further comments, they also got the view of those comments made in the past as part of killing the bill. And also know the reasons that we advise as justice for having reintroduced the bill as is before this select committee. Not because we undermine what people say. The minister will not do so, because the minister is a contrary process. They respond to the will of the people. You cannot go there and undermine what people are saying and still say that you are in a democracy. Democracy says you must listen to people. Participative democracy says listen to what people's views are. The fact that we've got this bill here does not mean that there's been an orchestrated move by the minister to undermine those views. But we have to bring those views to the select committee, together with all views that the select committee can hear, so that they can accelerate the process moving forward. And obviously guide the provincial legislatures in terms of deliberating on this bill, and guide on further consultation that may need to happen in terms of the bid. And from the department side, obviously, we'll always be there and willing to assist and take instructions from this committee, should it be necessary to do so. That's basically the overview I wanted to present to this select committee, and I hope that we'll find it very helpful as you deal with this very complex
piece of legislation that seeks to undo the history. And I'll allow my colleagues to add if there are few they want to act and to add, then we can take, we can be further guided by yourself, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I might just add one aspect to what my colleague has said, and I really want to do this to emphasize a fact that he has already emphasized, but I think the message must be clear. The Department has been criticized for bringing the same bill back to Parliament. We published this bill in the Gazette on the 13th of December last year, and let me just read, we published it with a view to get comments, further comments to what we've already seen. Let me quote, because I think the message must be made that the Department is not trying just to rush a bill through at the same bill. And I quote, "The bill was withdrawn from the National Assembly with the intention to introduce it in its current form in the NCOP in terms of Section 76 of the Constitution. Bearing in mind the statutory deadline of 30 December, by when the bill must be enacted into law, the intention is to have the concerns raised during the parliamentary process in the Portfolio Committee to date considered and addressed during the parliamentary process in the NCOP, in addition to any further comments or concerns that might be received." I want to make the point that we have already taken on board the concerns and will take on any further concerns. There was also criticism that we published this bill during the holiday season. There was a lot of criticism about that. Yes, it was published on the 13th of December, and we were very mindful of that because we've had similar criticism in the past, and that's why we have given the expiry date well after the holiday season into the middle of February. The Department recognizes the fact that the bill that we have before us today is going to be very different at the end of the day when we've gone through the parliamentary process and addressed the concerns. And I really want to stress that point. The Department shouldn't be seen to be pushing through a piece of legislation that was introduced in the same form in the NCOP. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, you can engage with the presentation. Honourable Matila, Honourable Bloom, Honourable Mokhobi.
Chair, we want to welcome the presentation. But Chair, we must indicate up front. You know, we are just from another testing situation. I mean, we were dealing with the information bill now. You see. And then there are lessons that we have learned through that particular process. And therefore, I think it is important that, Chair, it is important that we look at this particular bill and deal with it appropriately. Because the lessons we have learned around what happened in the National Assembly in terms of the information bill is that there was lack of consultation with the people on the ground. Which was a problem, because the intensiveness of our consultation on the ground made it clear to us that, in actual fact, people were not aware, and the media has been misleading communities on the ground in terms of that particular information. And I think it is important for us, you see, as this committee, to look at the bill and make sure that we consult properly and don't give the media, because I know they'll go out here, mislead communities again in terms as far as this particular bill is concerned, as they did with the information bill, because they tapped it something different that we don't even know. They called it a secrecy bill, whereas we don't have, even have a secrecy bill in front of us. And that's how they misled the community outside there. And I think it is important, Chair, that we take those lessons, implement those particular lessons and move forward with it. But I'm saying we're welcoming this bill. It is important that our legal gurus here come to us and make sure that they explain the constitutionality of this particular bill. They explain a lot of other issues that we think are important in making sure that this bill is in line with our own constitution. Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, thank you very much. I'm not going into the secrecy bill. I'm going into this one now. You see, I don't get clarity and a straight answer. Why is this bill before us?
now here today. The first pages, it's fine, but can they be specific? Why? Is the NA scared of this bill or what?
Thanks.
Now we'll call me.
Yeah, Chair, thank you very much. I just want to make to get it from the department, because I see various comments, but I don't see the comment or an expression from National House of Traditional Leaders, which is very much important as a point of departure. If we can get clarity, so that when we go there, the House also assists. Maybe the approach shall be very good in that way. The other thing is that I'm not sure. I think the Parliament or government must just get a way of beefing up state legal advisors. The experience we got when we dealt with the two bills of traditional leaders, 2009, really it was not palatable. I think we need to come so that when we consolidate various reports from provinces, we are not going like by going to and fro because of legal opinions that we received as committees. That's very much important, really, so that because I see this bill as very complex. It's not something that is easy, particularly when it involves tribunal forums, communities, and whatever. At the same time, the traditional leaders, in most cases, you would find that traditional leaders and communities sometimes do not see eye to eye. And we're going to have a very, very, very difficult program to drive. So these are just my comments. I don't want to go into the content because the content will come as we consolidate.
Before him, Honorable Duma and Zimande, Zulu, and those two has the Honorable Joseph.
Thank you, Chairperson. My concern in this bill is written in English. There's no inkosi khuluma isiNgisi, maybe abonke amakhosi is African languages special speakers. We request the department must provide us for 11 African or 9 African languages, especially in this bill. Also, I request the provincial department must consult, there's a proper consultation of a House of Traditional Leaders in their provinces, like our colleague here was referring to. There's no department talking about that. You must consult the House of Traditional Leaders national, because that thing will affect traditional community.
No, thanks. I think it was a blessing in disguise that Usulu has to come before me so that I can also redress. For me, it is immaterial that is written in Zulu because it can always be interpreted. It's neither here nor there. What is fundamental, what is happening, what was addressed? There are a lot of imbalances when you go into detail because for me, Chair, you don't need academia or academics to detail or to deal with this subject. You need to go to details to those remote rural areas, understand their pains, because it's true. I thought you was going to go to details because fortunately it's part and parcel of the systems. You go to some other instances where inkosi in the area they will subject abantu ukuthi ke awugqoke amabhulukwe, abantu in the area that they must pay levies when they are clear in the process. The exactly what you were articulating. There is an imbalance. It must be addressed as a matter of urgency as well. Fortunately enough, when you contextualize the issue of judiciary in South Africa, there are a lot of grey areas when you come to this. As a matter of fact, as I've already mentioned, that this bill, the Parliament must address it so that there are no contradictions in the process. As well, Chair, I think the issue of hypothetical analysis of traditional court is not going to assist us We just have to go into detail, just visit this thing. Unfortunately, the issue of time frame, for me, I don't think it's practical. We are racing against time. We are not going to, the time frames that are upon us, I don't think we're going to achieve them because of the reality as well. You go to KZN, there will be budget hearing. Unfortunately, we don't have the proper time analogy if we're going to do that because of the secrecy bill as well. I agree to Honorable Matila as well. You must ensure the issue of consultation this time. The media already has polarized the subject. You go to the ground already, the material condition is not conducive enough for explanation because it has been polarized. So if you can take all those things into cognizance, I think it will be good. Unfortunately, I thought controllers will be here so that they can also address what they were also saying, so that you can also understand their process. Because we must also ensure that we involve all the stakeholders in the initial phase, so that we understand their thought process as well. It's going to be clear in that process. But I think that will be our input, Chair. Thanks. But in KZN, hey, there's another province, Chair. You go to, that's where the exploitation of the system also turned to its fullest form.
Chair, it's where the president come from. KZN.
Let me be courteous to Bloom and ask to the department that I hope the in some of the submissions that they've had prior consultations that the Khoisan traditional people would somehow, you know, find way here. I think he forgot to ask that one, Chair. So I'm helping. I'm trying to. I'm applying for a job. Chairperson, if the department could clarify this deadline, of December. In much more simpler, I think the presenter said it's the statutory. Is it statutory because the parliamentary committee or the department requested for an extension up to 2012? So it's a technical statutory deadline, or what it is? Is it a matter of life and death? You know, beyond and around. And around that statutory date. And then secondly, Chair, I think the previous speakers also covered me in terms of the language, but I'm just thinking, Chair, that we might have to find brief summaries either of the presentation in particular for public education about the matters in a more conducive languages. Probably provinces might consider that just the summarized versions of the presentation of the contents, you know, of the content of the bill. And Chair, indeed, I think given the program of the committee, starting with the provincial week into the budget debates, the other bills that are coming to this committee, two or more bills that are coming, Chair, I think we need to be very lenient with provinces. The principle should be that we must be lenient with provinces. So that they do extensive consultations to the fullest. Chair, thank you.
Thanks, Chair. My name is Polile, Chairperson of Portfolio Committee of Local Government and International Affairs, Eastern Cape. Maybe just to comment as the first point on the issue of language. I think it's a serious matter. It cannot be said it's an issue that is neither here nor there. the issue of affirming African languages and the issues of access. Because when we talk about these matters, we're not talking only about traditional leaders, we talk about traditional communities. It is not about leaders understanding, it is about the people understanding. And therefore, it's quite a valid point, the issue of language here, to affirm African languages going forward. I don't think that, you know, it's quite correct to just dismiss it as if it's a non-point. The other point that I want to raise is that the issue of the objectives. I think it's a matter that the comments that were made is also emphasized, that there must be clarity on what is it that we, you know, the bill seeks to achieve. You know, whether, you know, does it seek to address the issues of transformation, or does it seeks to build a dual justice system in our country that is gravitating towards restoration of feudalism. So those are some of the issues that must be confronted in the process to what is it that you want to achieve. Do you want to deal with issues of transformation, deal with issues to ensure that these matters are in line with the Constitution, you deal with issues of corporal punishment and other issues relating to gender. We think that, you know, it's one of the issues that needs consideration going forward in terms of clarity in that respect. And the other point is that some of the assumptions, for instance, that are being made about the Eastern Cape, it talks again to the whole issue of the timelines, are quite not realistic, you know, whether it took, 8 weeks. There needs to be a thoroughgoing consultation with traditional communities, because some of the assumptions about the applicability in the Eastern Cape and the practice, you know, of the traditional justice system, you know, some of the assumptions might be entirely incorrect if you were to talk, you know, former Transkei and former Ciskei. You might have leaders there, but communities wouldn't be wanting to be subjected into the system. And therefore the issues of choice, you know, which are part of the Constitution, freedom of choice and association, whether being in this traditional community want to be subjected into this thing. So those are some of the things we think that maybe it's important that we must not be making assumptions about the Eastern Cape, about the applicability. I just wanted to raise those issues, primarily the issue of consultation is quite critical, and that we don't move with speed. Otherwise, there is a potential, you know, for conflict, in communities around this issue. And conflict in communities and in families. So it's quite important that we give the sensitivity to this. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. The speakers that spoke before me has covered me with regard to the issue of the time frame. I can't labor much on it. I'm sharing the same sentiments with them. But I also want the departments to clarify me in terms of the relation of this bill to the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act, and also to check as to whether this bill that is before us, in terms of its women representation into the traditional courts, as we know that women are still being regarded as minor in areas where traditional leadership is in force. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome to the presentation. I think what we need is a summary of those points raised in the National Assembly. I think the public must be made aware what was actually raised initially when the National Assembly have dealt with this. This bill. I think our experience from the National Council of Province side, our experience last year with taking Parliament to the people in KZN and the public meetings we had, and the complaints that we received from various women, and the visits we have done to the police stations, where all these complaints were laid, you know, with families and so on, and then the withdrawal of all those cases after the traditional process kicked in. Now, it plays a role, but the record was clear there. that it was the same people coming back every week, every second week, complaining about the same thing, and then they go through the same process while settling and reconciliation until the next weekend there's the same abuse, and particularly towards women. So I think it's a very important point that we need to take note of. The Constitution is supreme, and we need access to justice. That is key. So I think Parliament must introduce the act that makes us equal before the law, and the traditional courts should be used to enhance a formal structure for customary law within the framework of the Constitution. Thank you.
Chair, thank you. I guess we should welcome the presentation by the department. And indeed, I believe that the bill being introduced will assist to close the legal gap that we possibly do have. And I think I agree with everything that the presenter raised. But there is just one matter over and above the issues that colleagues have already raised, question of time, which is quite crucial. The question of the Bill of Rights, something that I think it would have been good if they had walked us through that aspect. You have certain situations in certain areas where you have people belonging to different cultures living in the same space. And if there's a dispute which would have been settled in different manner by different cultures, what happens in that kind of a situation? What if someone believes in a cultural system and the other person does not ascribe to that, if you have to then invoke this bill, what happens in those kind of situations? I think those, to me, are issues that I believe are quite crucial matters of this bill as against the Bill of Rights and a host of other related matters which relates to people's rights. I guess it would help us if there's some mini exposition on that matter.
That was question. The bill also talks about the training that will be given to the people designated to dispense justice. What kind of training will that be? You can respond.
Thanks, Chair, and thanks, Honourable Members. I think we welcome the inputs. The inputs are very forward-looking, and I think they seek to address the challenges which we faced with as we're mulling through the bill, this bill, and the constitutionality thereof. And I think we cannot agree more with the suggestion that there's a need to beef up the legal capacity in terms of making sure that we don't run into trouble with the bill. I'll take some of the few comments which have been raised, and my colleagues will take out some of the matters, etc. Chair, and I take some to have been comments that we must just be taken into consideration, but I respond to those which needed a kind of a direct response. Starting from the issue of the languages, the bill, when it was introduced, was translated into two languages. It was translated into the Swati language. And we have also put a process in motion to have the bill translated into all the languages. And I think during the consultation process which we have had with the institutional session leadership, we had made it a point that we translate all the key principles in all the languages, so that when we go to a particular area, at least we are able to engage and talk from that common perspective. So that is a process that we'll finalize. I think it's now up to, it's translated to about 6-7 languages, and I think we can complete that and make sure that this house, when it further engage in consultation, is in languages. The summary of the comments made during the National Assembly, the report is there. It has been condensed into all those inputs. Everything was captured, and I think the Secretary of the Portfolio Committee here can also ask assist the report if ours is not up to scratch, etc. deadline of 31 December, I'm saying the House may want to know that it was extended 4 times, if I'm not if I'm correct. I've said the bill was introduced in 2008. There was an anticipation that it could take 1 year to finalize. Then it was extended by Parliament, because the extension, because this act, these sections are saved by Parliament, so it become easier. Any extension will have to be put into legislation and be extended by Parliament. And I think all we're saying is that the current extension was last year, so there was an anticipation that in 2 years' time it could be closer to finality, etc. I think perhaps the best approach should be to get started and to monitor progress when you approach a deadline and see how you deal with that deadline. Rather than starting to extend the deadline before we get started, it may not come to fruition. Perhaps that may be what this House may want to look at, etc. The issue of choice, which Mr. Mahlangu mentioned, is dealt with in the bill and in a legal context. That's what we term the conflict of laws, where you find different legal systems apply. We had a thorough debate on the matter, and the approach taken in the bill is the following, that where the litigants, the parties before a court, subscribe to different cultural value system, one, it must first be based on consent between the parties, which system will want to apply there. You'll find that times Kosana, I'm in dispute with Motswana in-laws and different systems, whatever, but surely the parties can guide and agree with system. Then we then said, should there be no agreement, then the system that is closest to the dispute must then be adopted by the court, and should that be not agreeable, there should then be a process of trying to split a dispute. So there's a mechanism we've put in that may not be the perfect choice, but we wanted to avoid a situation where where the traditional courts impose one system over the people who do not subscribe to the system, taking into account the right of choice in the constitution, whatever. And all those are some of the aspects that can be dealt with in terms of this process. We have, in terms of National House of Social Leaders, we have really spent time with the House to extend that. When we started the drafting process, we've even established some form of a think tank that should basically look at aspects we wanted to put on the table. And we went beyond the National House and even consulted the provincial houses and invited the local houses for the consultation. In fact, when we went to the National Assembly, we were accused of having listened more to traditional leaders than to people, and which was a fair comment, because people saw us with them all the time, and not with all the people. But we don't agree with them. We met with them and made concessions where we felt was within the context of policy, and disagreed where we felt it would not achieve the objective of the bill, etc. And I'm sure you'll share yourself during the consultation processes that they would have loved to have a more expansive bill than what we have had. And there's always been the process of balancing from the various points, etc. As I've said, the matter is complex. And the issue of jurisdictions, traditional communities, what people subscribe to within the traditional communities, will always remain a subject, etc. But one thing about the customary law system is based on the principles which are almost the same. In all traditions, the approach of dealing with them may be different. But in all societies, you'll find that in all culture, you find that particular patterns of practices exist. You find that it's the extent to which you find that all the communities, when there's a death in their family, they go into a mourning process. just different how you born. Others are wearing clothes, others don't go out of the yard, others obsess and practice whatever. So they are there. So we have to find the mechanisms that make sure that the bill accesses the overall principles but does not go to specifics. What we intended to do is that there will then, once the bill has been passed, there will then be regulations that will talk to the issues on the ground and that will provide that of a form of flexibility to address particular instances that happen in a particular community without necessarily creating a distortion across the system, etc. And wanted also to emphasize that in our study we've also realized, hence we were pleading with those who say discard the system and throw it away, we found that most of the modern democracies are using their aborigines traditional system. Canada is one of them, Australia is one of them, India has got a well established traditional court system within their system. And it's simply because it recognizes the realities that those communities are there, they might well be given space to be able to embrace a system that basically is closest to their cultures and practices, whatever. And in all those countries, when we went to India, the Minister of Justice said, look, we've created space for the Lok Adalat system and the Panyat, that's what they call them, to develop and to evolve. We are not the ones, parliamentarians, to abolish it. It will, if it becomes, if it falls into disuse, so be it. But only we provide space for it to nourish and evolve within the context. Our constitution is more than that, because it provides even the development of the system, etc. I think those are the part of the system. I think we have taken note of the complexities in the Eastern Cape, in terms of the old Siska and Transkei. And I wanted to assure the honourable member from KwaZulu Natal that in fact Eastern Cape competes with KwaZulu Natal in terms of extension of the extent of the concerns and abuses that happens, etc. It is the very same court where the court, we've got also jurisprudence where the court have to declare some of the principles unconstitutional right at the beginning. Imprisonment was still allowed in the Eastern Cape in terms of the Transkei codified system, which was outlawed by the High Court there. The whole issue of customary laws, corporal punishment was outlawed by the Constitutional Court. It still continued at that point, and the bill seeks to deal with those aspects, etc. I leave the rest of my difficult questions to my colleagues. I've taken the easy ones.
Thanks, Chairperson. There was a question asked on the position of the Khoisan. When the bill was drafted in 2008, we took some of the definitions from the Framework Act, and due to the lapse of time, we are mindful of the fact that the Framework Act is in line for amendment, and this development will call for a need to review the bill with those developments in mind. So this is something that will still need to be looked into. And on that answer will also take care of the question on the relation of the Act to the Framework Act. On the issue of the representation of women, the role of women in the traditional justice system is one of the issues or of the concerns that has been raised with regard to the bill. And re-looking or reviewing the bill, you know, there, because there has been suggestions that the bill should be there should be provision made in the bill for the assistance that will be given to women litigants, and also to the constitution or the composition of the court in order to ensure meaningful participation of women. So this is also one of the aspects that will need to be re-looked into closely. There was a question asked on the objects of the bill, on whether it is transformatory, and on that I would like to say the aim of the bill is to provide for the structure and functioning of traditional courts in line with constitutional imperatives. And like my colleague has already mentioned, amongst others, the bill seeks to substitute the provisions of the repealed sections 12 and 20 of the Black Administration Act, which currently regulate the role and responsibilities of traditional leaders with regard to the traditional justice system. There was another question on the kind of training that the department is looking into providing to traditional leaders. Especially looking into the question of the rights of women, one of the areas of training that will need to be looked into and provided is the social context training, and as well as training on Bill of Rights, as the bill seeks to align the traditional justice system with the constitutional imperatives and values. Okay, and further to add on the question of whether the parties, what kind of provision is made for parties who, to say to maybe one of the parties who does not subscribe to the customary law of a particular community. You know, consideration, because as a department we are still looking at options as to how we can remedy some of the challenges that have been raised with regard to the bill. And a thinking has been whether to make a provision in the bill to make a provision for parties, for any of the parties to refer a matter to a magistrate court for adjudication. But as you know, consultation is prime in this area. It's a matter that will also need to be consulted on, so as to see how this area can be remedied.
Chair, there's another question I don't think that we've responded to. The question was, why is the bill here? Why is the NA centered here? Is the NA scared of this bill? No, I don't think that is the reason, Chair. My colleague right at the beginning said that we were criticized in the portfolio committee during the public hearings that there wasn't consultation, not that there wasn't consultation, because there was, and the portfolio committee recognized that, but the portfolio committee was worried that there wasn't sufficient consultation. And the portfolio committee recognized that the NCOP and select committee probably are better placed and better equipped to deal with the consultation process that was lacking in the first place. To deal with that through the provincial legislatures and the structures that are in place to make this consultation happen at grassroots level. So that is why it is here. It wasn't a case of being scared to deal with it. It recognized a very valid concern and thought it was better this house is better placed to deal with that. Perhaps just to add on to the relationship of the border between the Government's Framework Act, the government's, there were a few definitions that were used in the bill that come from the Government's Framework Act. We didn't want to reinvent the wheel. And there's also recognition of the fact that traditional leaders are recognized in terms of that Government's Framework Act, and we built on that, and also on the provision in the, I think it's clause 16, dealing with incapacity, gross incompetence, or misconduct of presiding officers. The Government's Framework Act was also used in the provincial legislature, provincial legislation dealing with removal, I think, of traditional leaders. So those are two more concrete aspects on which we relied on the Government's Framework Act. Thank you.
Just to emphasize two points here. One is the issue of training. Not only have we taken the training of traditional leadership seriously, but we perceive that as a fundamental of fundamental importance to avoid or to eliminate all these concerns and challenges that continue to exist. To that extent, this parliament has passed the South African Judicial Education Institution Act, which aims to train judges and magistrates, and it was implemented act that, to the extent that that institution must train people for dispute resolution, must also involve traditional leaders. Hence, the council that runs that act includes representation from the traditional leaders, and the deputy chair person of the National House, Khoshigadi Mothapo, is a member of that council, and it needs to see how it capacitates traditional leaders to make sure that they operate within the confines of the constitution, and to eliminate the abuses, and to make it very clear that if you move outside the constitution, you will be liable for the excess of power, and you may find yourself on the wrong side of the constitution. So that's what stressed that, and we continue to provide training in terms of Justice College, and we had, in terms of this bill, made firm commitment that the Department of Justice will assume responsibility for capacitating the courts, training everybody in the court system, in terms of the new legislation, in terms of human rights, in terms of sensitivity. Traditional leaders, clerks of those courts, and all people associated with those courts. We even said that would even go to the extent of appointing paralegals to go and assist those courts to make sure that they operate within the context of the law. All the other work is dealt with, of the traditional courts in terms of support structure, is dealt with by the Department of Traditional Affairs. They are the ones who make sure that there's sufficient accommodation, there's sufficient capacity in terms of the traditional leaders' overall function. Justice role is to capacitate the courts in terms of their adjudication function. And that's what we have made that commitment in terms of the bill. And I think the minister will still continue that commitment at the end of the day. Thanks, Chair, for the indulgence.
Yeah, Chair. When we were dealing with the framework bill, Chair, in the middle of it, we discovered that there was no costing of the bill. Now the department must declare now up front if this bill is costed. If not, for immediate effect, how does it feature in the MTF or the strike plans, 5-year strike plans, if they still have those in the department? And also, Chair, the issue of the, you know, in one area, say, take Inkandla as 18 chiefs, and with different communities there, and all the jurisdictions and boundaries. Chair, I hope that in their study have looked into how would that, be taken care of,
including Chair, the because my understanding also that the department has introduced the small claims courts, you know, which also creates a relationship between this and that claims court, because the purpose of that small claims court also small claims court is to provide better access at affordable levels between parties that are talking to each other. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Bloom.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the first point is on the proposed program. I will propose that as a committee, we are going to sit and draft our own program, so that it's unrealistic, the thing that is here. We will never do it in this year. I can tell you now that it's not. We are going to do it. And then, Chair.
Just a moment, Honorable. Gashin will still inform provinces about the proposed program, so that they go and check their programs. Yes, but can you hold your comments before that?
I will, Chair. But I have raised a concern. Louis, you are not the chair. then I'm going to this point of the National Assembly. You see, Chair, we are dealing here with taxpayers' money. There was already public hearings in the whole of the country. Now, because of concerns, they are sending this bill to the NCOP. It is unacceptable to me that they, in the National Assembly, could not address those concerns, because they were dealing with this thing since 2008. I'm raising that, Chair.
Okay. That is not it, Honorable Member.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Nomzoya Swartboy from KZN. Chairperson, we just want to the department to give us the concerns and the responses that were submitted to the department. Because when we draft, we have our own program, we go back to the same communities, they will raise the same concerns. That is number one. On the issue of the program, I'm covered, Chairperson. When it is said that provinces must look in at their programs and then submit to your committee, because as it is now, I think we don't want pressure. Yeah, and another concern that I have, Chairperson, this bill also proposes that the headmen or headwomen or izinduna can preside over the court. According to the culture in KwaZulu-Natal, there's no situation where Induna has presided over formal hearings, and Induna has not been empowered to do so. The second one is the issue of the funds that will be collected. The fines that will be collected from the people, according to the proposal of the bill, they are supposed to be submitted to the provincial revenue fund. Yes, that will require the department to have a substantial structure to actually manage those funds, and it will also put pressure on the Auditor General, because the department will have to explain about the funds that were collected. The fourth one is, we don't have a policy, a clear policy to say
how are these funds going to be collected? Because you'll find instances in the same community, under the same traditional leader, where people have done the same offense, but having to pay different fines that are not the same. So we need to be clarified there, because I think that there should be a consistency of some sort. I think.
Honorable Matila.
Yeah. Not Chair. I thought the department was here to introduce this bill to us. Then we will later deal with the content of the bill itself. Well, that's what I thought will happen today. But the second point, Chair, is that particularly around the program itself. You see, my problem and concern is that, you know, we have the same deadlines for everything that comes before us. Almost the same deadlines, in which is a problem to me. Because how are we going to manage that, those times and everything else? Because it's not realistic. You see, it's not realistic. Because for a clear example, it's just the information bill. It's the same deadlines that we have in front of us. We must deal with the same situation. And I'm just saying, this is the situation. There's a lot of pressure coming to us and to the same committee, the same setup, which is a problem. And I think it's important for us to relook at that situation.
Honorable Matila, just as I stopped Honorable Blue, can you wait on the issue?
No, I agree. I just wanted to bring that to your attention. So that there's no
problem. Can you wait on the issue of the program? Gashin, can you brief the members about the program?
Yes, Chairperson. In terms of this proposed program, this was developed in terms of the NCOP's 6-week cycle. But the committee can ask for an extension of that 6-week cycle based on the legislature's difficulties with running a program of this nature. So what we would need from the provinces is for the provinces to send us its programs. And then if it has difficulty in reaching every community, a tribal community, etc., then we can motivate from our side that there would be need to be an extension on the program. But just in terms of the National Council of Provinces and its 6-week cycle, this program was developed in terms of that.
So we understand, but also saying, you see, provinces must also be guided, you see, in terms of our own program here. Because, you see, if we don't deal with it that way, KwaZulu-Natal will have a different program. The Eastern Cape will have a different program, you know. And if we're not guiding each other, so that we then have one particular program and work on it, you know, that will assist us in dealing with that situation, Chair.
I suggest, Chairperson, that we have the negotiating mandates on the 30th of May. Bloom, you always disturb. You are not
order.
The Chairperson.
Order.
Well, you're still on the floor.
Yes, I'm still on the floor.
I withdraw.
Yeah, just withdraw. Okay.
On the court floor. This is not a court. We're human presidents of court.
Honorable Bloom.
It is just a proposal, Chairperson, to say, can we have the negotiating mandates on the 30th of May, and then on the final mandates to be held in August.
Goodness.
Education is not supposed to give us a program a draft program that they did so that we can work on it.
We note that proposal, and we will meet and communicate to the provinces as the committee. Yes, Honorable Nzimande. Yes. That is correct.
Thanks, Chair. I think there was one direct question on the issue of cost. From the department perspective, I've indicated that the department has looked into its own responsibilities that flow from the bill and properly budgeted for those responsibilities in accordance with the MTF cycle. And our budget basically relates to the aspects of training. Our budget relates to the issue of training, which will take full responsibility thereof, and also relate to the issue of capacity building of the courts in terms of dispute resolution. I've said that we look at getting some paralegals to go and assist whatever those who are committed to. The Department of Cultural Affairs because they already do that. They are responsible for providing the necessary support structure for the traditional communities. So we are not going to come with our own justice-related structures next to what they've put in place. We have said our system is not courts. We do not envisage, and we have said to most traditional leaders, Department of Justice will not go to each and every of their 1,800 something social communities and build a court. Because not knowing the traditional form, the system starts, the system of dispute resolution, and it is known that happens everywhere. It happens in community buildings, it happens under a tree, it happens at home, etc. So you extend that the system will provide its support, but not go beyond that. Whilst I'm there, so the issue of budgeting in terms of the justice commitments has also been factored into the bill, etc. The second aspect, Chair, which I wanted to raise quickly is that we have acknowledged the fact that the bill does not recognize the different layers of dispute resolution. And what will be revised, that there will be instances where the head men and head women participate at their own level, different from the courts and different from the family level, whatever, those who have acknowledged the session. Thanks, Chair.
Chair, I think it is important that upfront we indicate, you know, just last year we were dealing with the traditional, another bill around traditional leadership. And all these unfunded mandates that goes to local government, whilst we know local government has got a problem, that goes to provinces, you know? Because I see that thing coming up now, too, you see, because it becomes an unfunded mandate, you know? Those layers down there of governance, you know, suffer precisely because national just take decisions and they're not worried about the cost implications to that layer of governance. And I think it is important that we look into this specific matter. You see, I'm telling you, traditional coordinators in the provinces were not even paid last year. There was a problem around it. Now you're bringing an extra burden to that particular level now. Yeah, which is a problem. And national departments just take decisions, come with different decisions which affects the structures locally, financially, which is a problem.
I think to avoid that, we are legislators. We are not executive. And we pass budget to the executive. All what you need to do is that they go back, relate to the minister that this thing must be funded. So I don't believe we need negotiation. It should be like that. The other issue is that the other experience of Section 76 is that when we go to provinces as delegates, you have to be given technical support by the department. But in most cases, find that the person that's supposed to be coming is not coming, and you are a politician. So that also must be prepared so that when we go out, those who will be coming to come and give the technical support to those various MPs in various provinces must be there in time. Because sometimes you get province complaining against you as an MP, and there are certain things that are too technical for you to clarify. I think that also must be an obligation of the department before we even start to arrange that. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. On a lighter note, I'm not representing the ANC Youth League, but I must just mention that in our midst there is Inkosi Umdletshe as well, who's coming from the province of KZN. He has joined us. He's not progressive from Contra Lesa, but he's in our midst as well. So Makeba is happy as well. I think we must indicate that. But let me proceed, Chair. I'm glad the Honourable Matila is raising this issue. Unfortunately, because even last year we did indicate that this is going to be audit query in most of the provinces on the issue of COCTA if it's not raised now. That is why we must articulate it correctly so that there should be a proper budget allocation properly, because if it's not done properly, it is going to give us a problem. In fact, we are looking forward to a clean audit somewhere around 2016. It's not going to happen. We are not going to achieve it because it looks like we are not proactively planning it in terms of our planning stages. We are contradicting ourselves. It's not correct, Chair. I think somehow we must create a stage where we're going to have a committee, select committee, or did this committee have a proper synergy where I don't know, Honorable Matila was suggesting that minister must create an ambit where we are going to holistically look upon this issue, that in the near future it is not happening, because you end up saying that you are supposed to do this, we are supposed to do this, we end up having all this digital process. So I think we must address this as a matter of urgency from now on. Other than that, we'll have a problem. I don't know, Chair, how are you going to tackle it? As much as it is coming from Honorable Bloom, I think we must entertain this point, Chair. I think it's a little bit progressive. You know, of us, you must come back from the pledge between the ANC. So the issue of public, I think, I don't know whether you start afresh the entire process. That is why the issue of collecting the data analysis already is there. Whether you start afresh that process in terms of fiscal, is it allowing us? You must also think around those processes, because it has already been done. You might even arrive in the same conclusion, by the way. Why are you going to do the same exercise on the same bread? So you must be clear strategic, because even if you want to use the same scientific analysis, you'll find the same argument as well. So you must be cautious around those issues, Chair, as well. You must take them into cognizance. Thanks.
Okay. Honourable members, you are the last two.
Thank you, Chair. On the issue of unfunded mandate, I wanted to check with other provinces, because in our five-year strat plan, we are putting in plans and budgets for, like, for instance, lawmaking and public participation, so that when such an issue arises, there is an accommodation of some funds relating to whatever exercise that you want to embark on. But I think also Honorable Mohobi has covered me on the issue of us taking the matter to the executive so that they must talk to it. So that's why I was a bit worried when we say with an unfunded mandate, because portfolio committees have their threat plan, and it's the five-year threat plan, whereby you have to plan for your own lawmaking processes, your public participation, and so forth. So how would this then affect the processes when we say it's an unfunded mandate? Thanks.
Thanks, sir. Just one last point, Chairperson, on the issue of unfunded mandate. I think it applies to the whole issue of the actual implementation once this has become a law. As we speak in the Eastern Cape, after the elections of traditional councils, and we had to ensure that they are sewn in. They have started working. We can't pay allowances. That causes tensions. So it's the whole issue of unfunded mandate. So it's not a small issue. It's not about public participation per se. It's bigger than that. Yeah.
The honourable members, those issues that has been raised are noted, and we will deal with them next week Wednesday when we meet. And this then brings us to the end of the meeting. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.